although this might look like it's something entirely different, it's actually kind of a branch of more further adventures of the Euler-Poincaré approach. Okay, so we've heard about modeling in turbulence. There have been a long series of models that have been using the Euler-Poincaré approach, which is based on Lagrangian reduction for fluids, in to coordinate the ocean models, the various ocean circulation models. And the one of the issues about this is eventually we'd be interested in trying to do climate models, and maybe perhaps with this approach. But another branch of the same type of analysis applies to the exotic fluids, superfluids, the order parameter fluids, and also liquid crystals. I'm going to talk about the experiments in superfluids that are being done at Oregon, at Eugene, and at Yale. And I'm going to talk about what the experimental result is, say something about the puzzle that raised, and then give an equation which describes precisely what they measured. And it's in the new theory of superfluid dynamics that's based on the Euler-Poincaré approach. So most people probably have seen a phase diagram in pressure and temperature for helium, for liquid helium. Here's helium gas down here. This is its critical point. Here's liquid helium. Under high pressures, the helium can become solid. But the thing which interests us here is that there are two phases of liquid helium, which are called helium 1 and helium 2. Helium 1 is the ideal, it's the perfect fluid to be described by the Navier-Stokes equations because the molecules have no internal structure; they just bounce off of each other. On the other hand, as you decrease the temperature down below about 2.17 degrees Kelvin, then helium makes a transition, an order parameter transition, which is a second order transition, to helium 2, where it becomes a superfluid. Here's the lambda point. Here's the normal fluid divided by the total density divided by the total mass density. Here's a superfluid. See, a little bit of superfluid forms, and then eventually, as temperature decreases, it goes to entirely superfluid. Okay, so experiments turn out to be done between about 1.3 and 1.7 degrees, where things are sort of 50-50, superfluid and normal fluid. Most people know that liquid helium 2 is sort of a magical, interesting liquid. In particular, if you have liquid helium 2 in a bucket, say above the lambda point, you start this bucket rotating, what will happen is that you'll get the meniscus, the parabolic meniscus that in uniform rotation that Newton measured. And if you then cool this thing, so what happens is that the vortices in the superfluid become quantized. They have a unit of circulation, which is H over M. And even though both of these are microscopic quantities, their ratio is in CGS units about 10 to the minus 3 centimeters squared per second. What's M is the mass of the helium atom. Okay, so now these were introduced by Feynman and Ozziger in the 50s, the idea of quantized circulation. And there's a way of measuring that these things exist, and it's been since the 50s been tested very well, and that is that you can introduce excitations by heating from the side, and probably people know that there's another branch of sound propagation called second sound, which is a temperature wave that in fact gets absorbed into oscillations and bending of these superfluid vortices. And it turns out that in rigid rotation, the second sound absorption or attenuation divided by 2 omega, that's the vorticity of rigid rotation, is just equal to a constant. So it's that constant is actually, so each of the vortices has the same circulation. So you have to think of quantized things that come in a circulation unit. So they're like a vortex filament with a constant circulation. Yes, it is. We'll look at a particular temperature. And the other thing is that when it goes through the lambda point, the conductivity of heat goes way high. So isothermal temperature is a very good approximation. Well, okay, so the point is that the second sound attenuation divided by the rotation rate is a constant. It's equal to the number of these quantum vortices times their length. Okay, so this is how you measure the presence of these quantum vortices in a superfluid that has rotation. Now the basic variable is the vortex line density. This means the line length per unit volume. Okay, and you can think of it as the magnitude of omega divided by the circulation of a quantum vortex. Okay, so when they measure absorption in a rotating bucket, in this configuration, they're just measuring the length of the vortices. Okay, and now there's another feature. This length per unit volume, first of all, what's the density of these vortices is like 1 or 2,000 per square millimeter when you're rotating at a few hertz. Okay, so there are a lot of these vortices, and one can imagine trying to make a macroscopic description looking at the area density of these things. But L itself introduces another length scale. The total length divided by the volumes, the length per unit volume, is a length scale. That's a parameter which we'll have to deal with eventually. Okay, so this is the simple situation where you have rigid rotation, and you can do things that are very accurate to identify you've got quantum vortices in there, like depositing ions on them and taking pictures from the top and studying the triangular lattice patterns that develop. So these guys at Oregon have gone further, and what they did was they took a cryogenic liquid helium with the second sound transmitter bouncing back and forth, so it would tell how many vortices, the length of the vortex lines are in there. And then they basically pulled a grid through, rapidly pulled it several meters per second, through this region that they're measuring, and that spun up the normal fluid, which then creates a vortex tangle whose length they measure, and then study the length of the vortex tangle. That's how it decays as a function of time. Here's the result. They showed, they measure their Reynolds number by the size of the mesh, which is the mesh is like 0.167 millimeters in size. So the Reynolds numbers go up to about a million. And for each of these Reynolds numbers, what happens when they measure the line length, but then they interpret this as vorticity by multiplying by the quantum of vorticity. And the reason why they aren't having double quantums or something like that is that the energy to create one of these vortices is proportional to its length and is and proportional to kappa squared. Okay, so a circulation with circulation 2 kappa will break up into 4 of these single ones. It's unstable to breaking in. So they all have circulation kappa. And they measure this decay as a function of time, And look how they measure. This is 6 orders of magnitude, you know, over 3 orders of magnitude in time. So this is a wide dynamic range measurement. And all of these things, as they start, here different colors correspond to them starting, they all go wham down onto a t to the minus 3/2 curve, which is what you would get from a k to the minus 5/3 energy spectrum. So they interpreted this to mean that the superfluid... Oh, yeah, that's true.
Isotropic turbulence with no
large-scale boundary conditions. Oh, no, there is a large-scale boundary. It's the size of the bucket. It's the size of the bucket.
Right. That is true.
Okay, so the issue is, why does this decay show classical scaling? Okay, and the Donnelly group at Oregon started to explain this in terms of the superflow being locked or slaved to the normal flow. Now, that's an interesting concept, because it might mean, for example, that you could use superfluid liquid helium to do ordinary turbulence experiments, have an ordinary turbulence interpretation, but it's over a very wide range of Reynolds numbers and Rayleigh numbers and things like that. The Rayleigh numbers they get for convection, about which I'm not talking, are the widest available. They're 11 orders of magnitude. That's one possibility. The things just slave to the normal flow, and the decay of the normal turbulence determines everything. Another possibility that's just sort of an intermediate possibility that was raised by Samuels for saying that maybe these things are not slaved, you know, because these guys are actually coupled to each other, and maybe the superfluid drains its energy into the normal fluid by exciting some sort of instabilities in the normal fluid, and then you see it, you know, being pulled at some rate. The view I want to propose is that the superfluid vortex line density has its own dynamics, and those dynamics just happen to give that scale. Okay, and I don't have a mechanism for how they give that scale, but I can give you an equation that describes the dynamics of what those guys are measuring. So then we can look at the next step. Okay, so a question is, how should this Landau two-fluid model be modified to include the dynamics of the vortex tangle? Now, Landau model has that the curl of the superfluid velocity is zero. The superfluid velocity is grad phi. Well, you have to introduce an equation for how that dynamics changes, and this was introduced right away by Vinen and Hall in their rotating bucket experiments when they were measuring the lengths of those lines. They introduced some dimensional analysis to say that line length might be created like L to the 3/2 and destroyed like L squared. So, and they were thinking of a homogeneous, spatially not varying situation. I'd like to take the inspiration from their formula to basically ask how would time derivatives and how does gradients appear in this equation. So Klaus Schwartz, began at IBM all through the mid-80s to the end of the 80s, has been simulating vortex dynamics using the nonlinear Schrödinger equation. And he derived these coefficients A and B from thinking about basically the localized induction approximation and the Hashimoto transformation that came up earlier for the filament. No, he interprets it as vortex dynamics by using the Hashimoto transformation, but he is integrating the nonlinear Schrödinger equation. And he specifies 3D, but with a fixed normal velocity driving. Okay, so it's not self-consistent. It is how the normal fluid drives the superfluid. What? The damping is in... I'll talk about that in a minute. There's damping in the normal fluid. It has normal ordinary viscosity. And then there's a coupling between them. So, what? No, Schwartz just left the normal fluid just driving.
When you say you derive
Oh, well, here's what he did. What? Yes, B is a damping factor. He assumed that when the vortex lines became close enough, they reconnected. Okay, but they're all interpreted from. No, they're actually nonlinear Schrödinger, but you just do the transformation that Hashimoto did with the localized induction. Grashe and Noor and others updated some of these calculations and actually studied how the nonlinear Schrödinger equation at t equals zero. See, nonlinear Schrödinger applies at t equals zero when there isn't a normal fluid. And we're in the place where we have normal fluid. So we need a different model. No. Boris is right. They have. If you can excite, Kelvin waves on these filaments, and those Kelvin waves can couple the second sound, which might then radiate energy away. But this is actually not the purpose of my talk. I'm not going to say much more about vortex dynamics. I want to describe macroscopic hydrodynamic equations, which will give an equation for what's measured in this experiment. And, I'm not going to do it in one vortex line at a time. I need a distribution of these things. But there have been a lot of studies, though, of the various forces on the line vortex, and many of these studies are interesting and intricate and very geometrical. So if you think of here's a line vortex coming out of the board. This circulation is kappa. And then you ask, what are the forces on such a vortex? In a flow, there is a Magnus force, which is beautifully described by Thallus and others in terms of Berry phase dynamics. It was modeled by Hall and Vinon as a constant times the transverse direction to the difference in velocities. They proposed that constant was the superfluid density times the circulation, and that's held up real well. There are other types of forces that people introduce. This is another nice geometric force which is derived by an analogy to the Aranha-Bohm effect, but for phonons, and taking higher order corrections to the Born approximation, just like in the geometric phase for the Aranha-Bohm and for electrodynamics. Another force is basically impurities and external fields. These first two forces are Galilean invariant, and the third one is easily distinguished by being not Galilean invariant. But you notice that there's a different velocity here, Vn and Vs. And Vl is the velocity that the vortex line moves with, and it's neither Vn nor Vs because it has self-induction. Okay, so if we want a hydrodynamical description of this problem, we can actually look back in the literature, starting with Landau's two-fluid theory. There have been many different approaches to deriving these equations, and including the hydrodynamic description of the vortex tangle. You might just notice that Kolotnikov started in 51 with the variational principle. 10 years later, he was working in phenomenological form with Bekarevich and Kolotnikov. They were inputting experimental models from Hall and Vinon. And, later, Kolotnikov, another 2 decades later, is still working on this problem using the Poisson bracket approach. It's an interesting, deep problem. And it turns out that the main issue in all of these is that one has to introduce the momentum of the vortex tangle, so the hydrodynamic momentum, the momentum associated with another fluidic degree of freedom, without introducing additional inertia, because the vortex lines have no inertia. They're one angstrom across. They're just going to. There's going to be a force balance. But Boris, I'll get back to you then. You think they have inertia? Bame and others introduced an effective mass for the core, right? This is a small effect. There's boatloads. No, that's right. No, that's right. Well, actually, it's great statistical mechanics. Well, I didn't introduce anything about, for example, the helium-4 films and the Kosterlitz-Thouless transition. Okay, that's where the, in two dimensions, the helium-4 vortices have been studied from the statistical mechanical viewpoint very deeply, because there's a transition where the vortices become unbound, they spread out. It's a disorder, order-disorder transition. There's a lot of stuff. Okay, so the Wheeler-Poincaré variational formulation I'm going to use has several benefits. It guarantees proper conservation laws, proper circulation theorems. It turns out it can be used to add momentum for the vortex tangle, but not inertia. And it also gives a geometrical framework for adding the same, it's the same type of behavior, namely dynamics for the defects in other fields. And that's the issue, is allowing the defects to have their own degree of freedom and their own dynamics. So, you've seen Ed Starr earlier in Jerry's lectures. The basic idea is that I have a momentum for the normal flow and also a momentum for the vortex line flow. Okay, the momentum is the variation with respect to the velocity. And I have a framework for computing these equations of motion, and here's how they look. They are basically like the Bekarevich and Kolotnikov 1961 paper, but updated in various terms. But their form is conservation laws for mass, momentum, and energy, where the total mass is the sum here. The total momentum is rho SVS plus rho NVN. And the stress tensor is exactly what you would write if you were just summing up all the momenta. It's like two copies of the momentum for an Euler fluid. And the pressure is drives the total momentum here. The energy has this form. It has this is sort of a famous J dot V coupling. And the potential energy depends on all these quantities. These are the thermodynamic derivatives. The one I want to point to is lambda. This is where things start getting connected to the alpha model again. Sure. Oh, okay. Well, I'll even try to explain why you would want to introduce it. The energy has to depend on the vorticity, because if you have the vortex lines have an energy, the filament line, which is proportional to their length times geometrical factors. Okay? And the length... it doesn't work that way. If you try to, add vortex length, you add that same factor, some geometric factor, times the length of the vortex. So if you ask, that's a very great question. If you ask, how does the energy depend on the length of the vortex? Okay, I'll tell you. So, yeah, just right. Right, they're in VS, right, and already, and we're going to get VL in a minute. We get VL, we actually get VL from the variational principle. This is simply coming from the change of the potential energy with the length of the line, and the length of the line is the magnitude of omega divided by this kappa. Now. This is the main idea here. I'm writing the superfluid velocity as a part with no curl minus with this sign of malice of forethought, minus A, instead of looking like a vector potential, kind of an analogy to superconductor theory, and all of the curl is in A. Okay, so now I've regularized the phase. And I need an equation for A, and I will get an equation for VS. I'll use basically use the Landau theory for that part, and what's remaining I'll use for that part. Okay, so, and then the other feature is that the temperature is the variation with the entropy, and the entropy is pulled around by the normal fluid, and there's whatever losses here. Okay, so not surprisingly, the superfluid velocity has a Kelvin theorem, but now the loop is moving with another speed, VL. Okay, and that VL is going to include the macroscopic representation of the self-induction velocity. And it is equal to the mass average velocity, V bar, plus 1 over rho times the curl of that lambda, and lambda is our derivative of the energy with respect to omega. So it happens there's also another circulation theorem for the other velocities in the problem, but I want to concentrate on this one. I'll explain why. It's because it's closely connected to the measurement and to Vinon's equation. So remember, Vinon's equation is for this quantity L, which is magnitude of omega divided by the circulation quantum. So this is the vortex line length per unit volume. So if you think about your Kelvin theorem, the Kelvin theorem ordinarily thinks in terms of the flux, but now what you have to do is think of the omega through a given little surface element moving with velocity VL and take the magnitude of it. So you take omega and then you dot it with omega hat. So this one has length 1, 2, 3, 4, even though it has flux 2. Okay? So, well, the discussion centers on sort of what is this? Is this a geometrical quantity or not? And it turns out that it's perfectly acceptable. Here's the Kelvin theorem written in terms of vortex dynamics. Here is this VL here. This is V capital L. It's V little L, which is the guy that came from the variational principle. Then plus another bit, which is this is where the friction comes between the normal fluid and the superfluid. This is the whole coupling. You know, the rest of this is the friction, and this is what's going to give an equation for L, and this is the Hall-Vinon friction term. Okay, so if lambda is the derivative of E with respect to omega, well, it's dEdl dOmega, and dL dOmega is omega hat, and dEdl is some constant that's new. No, that's not coming from the variational principle. This is called Vinon's coefficient B, and it's a function of temperature. And rho n is also a function of temperature. And as temperature goes lower, rho n goes to zero. This gets dropped, and what remains is just the induction formulas. And you go back to nonlinear Schrodinger-like things. All right, so we have an expression for L. It's related to the expression for omega. We can just compute the time derivative. It is a divergence of a flux. There's the transport term. And here's where the friction comes in. And all this groups together into a negative definite combination that depends on temperature. So what they measure is the integral over their volume of L, right? And how does it change with time? Well, there's a part that's bounded coming from the first two lines, and there's this part here, which apparently leads to this t to the minus 3/2 decay in the experiment. And the only place where the normal fluid comes in is here, right? So this is the dynamics of the Kelvin theorem for the vortex tangle that's doing that. And for the mathematicians, look, omega is bounded in L1, not in L2. Okay, in the alpha model, omega is bounded in L2. So this is a much more delicate theory to deal with. Because their energy here depends on omega hat. If the energy were just depending on omega, right, then you would in fact get L2. But you only get L1 because it's a field of directions that's involved. Yeah. Yeah. All right. This is how Wiener's equation changes when you're inhomogeneous. A modulo adding more physics to the superfluid equation. No, not quite. It's more a measure of the curvature. Okay? This omega, we're interested in omega hat cross curl omega hat. So if you want to make an interpretation in terms of a vortex filament to get more on familiar grounds, then you come here. Each filament has a vorticity with the same magnitude kappa. There's omega hat. Omega hat is the tangent to the filament line. Right? There's the normal to it. Here's the direction of the velocity from the local induction approximation. So let's just take the local induction approximation to be something, some constant times that. This is the magnitude of this S prime cross S double prime is the radius of curvature. The curvature. A little calculus allows you to write this guy as S prime cross omega prime. We identify S prime with omega hat. The square of this then is the curvature. So it's the square of the curvature. So what's happening is that the more tightly wound and bent the vortex tangle is, the more it decays, the faster it decays. This is that's right. It's thought of as friction, but in fact maybe it's some state trapping the normal fluid inside of it or something when it's tightly wound. Yes. And it's proportional. See, it's proportional to omega hat. Okay. So here I want to make some, now I want to make some wild guesses and finish up. These guys saw a scaling that corresponds to the k to the minus 5/3 scaling with the large low k cutoff. Okay, they're t to the minus 5/3. So you would infer from there maybe they were looking at k to the minus 5/3. But at some wave number, which dimensionally could be the square root of this density of vortex line length, you can imagine that the mutual friction will increase the damping. And if this length scale were separated from the Kolmogorov length scale, you would expect to see something turn over faster than k to the minus 5/3. Okay, that's so. If one can look at superfluid experiments for which we can begin to separate these two length scales, then maybe you would expect to see that the superfluid vortex tangle is behaving differently than classical turbulence. And if you estimate what this is in their experiment, it turns out to be about a micron, which is, of course, about what they think the Kolmogorov's length is, too. So they are sitting with this wave number and the Kolmogorov dissipation wave number, the ratio of order 1. And nonetheless, I think that this is the guess that might be worth taking. Okay, so one more statement about the connection to the alpha models. The alpha model has a Lagrangian, which has already been written a couple of times. It's u squared plus alpha squared times the mod gradient of u. For a divergenceless flow, this is can also be written, in the periodic domain as proportional to omega squared. So the difference between this and the alpha model is mod omega squared versus magnitude of omega in this energy term. That's one difference. I'll stop there. No, no, I didn't propose that at all. No. No, I simply said that their t to the minus 3/2, you know, agrees with the classical turbulent scaling. Oh, yeah, we could also be, yeah. Okay, thank you. That's a really good point. I've been telling these guys the same, more or less the same thing. If they're seeing this universal scaling behavior for an entirely different equation, that's not to be unexpected. I mean, Kolmogorov got this k to the minus 5/3 scaling without using the Navier-Stokes equation. So, and then that break that I showed may actually be an interesting thing to look at, because this Kolmogorov constant, you know, may change with temperature, or when you get, when you're able to get that other length scale into the problem, you should get other scalings. Okay. So actually, so even if that other wave number were in the problem and there was some kind of universality to this, to the scaling, then you shouldn't see the break. That's why it's interesting to check.